From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The film The Cove, which shows a secret dolphin killing field in Japan, is a favorite to win this year's Academy Award for Best Documentary. In the first half hour, my conversation with Dubuque native Luis Cejuyas, who directed and starred in the film. Then in the second half hour, photojournalist and author Chip Duncan. Duncan grew up in Shenandoah, in Council Bluffs. His new book is titled Enough to Go Around, Searching for Hope in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. Written in the first person, the book captures images Duncan says we see far too little in the West, like proud, smiling Muslim men. That's all coming up this hour, following a look at the news. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Sunday, March 7th, documentary filmmaker and Dubuque native Luis Cejuyas may well have 45 seconds to talk to the world. He's been nominated for an Academy Award as director of The Cove, which documents the largest dolphin slaughter in the world. It's considered the odds-on favorite to win, already claiming more than 50 awards, including the Audience Award at last year's Sundance Festival. But Cejuyas insists he's not a filmmaker. He just wants to change the world. I talked with him recently about The Cove and asked about the dirty little secret he uncovered in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, everything about the town, when you drive into it, you know, you would think that they love dolphins and whales. In fact, there's a sign in English as you come into the town that says, "We love dolphins." But right in the center of town, in a Japanese national park, a marine sanctuary, a nature sanctuary, is a place where they kill more dolphins than any other place on the planet. This is the center of the captive dolphin industry. Most of the captive dolphins in the world, they see at, you know, hotels, swim with dolphin parks and dolphinariums around the world, come out of this little town in Taiji. And the ones that they capture them out of the wild, and the ones that they don't use for the captive dolphin industry, they're looking for primarily, you know, young females. They take around to the secret cove and they kill them by the thousands every year.
So why do the dolphins come there?
Well, they're using migratory routes that they've been using for thousands of years, and they're just basically minding their own business. They're going from feeding grounds from the north to the south somewhere, and these Japanese dolphin hunters wait outside of town, you know, in the water in these boats, 13 boats, and when they see the pods come by, they drop these long poles in the water, and they start banging them with pipes, and this creates a underwater wall of sound, if you will, and it pushes the dolphins into this secret cove. And they do this every year from September to March. And we're actually right in the, you know, towards the end of the killing season right now. They're killing dolphins, you know, as we're speaking. And this happens every year. And it's been going on. It's only been going on since 1933. The Japanese government likes to say this is their tradition. Well, you know, my mother, who lives in Iowa, is older than their tradition. So, you know, it's disingenuous to say that it's, you know, their tradition. And, you know, they used to do this with canoes, and they pound a few rocks underwater, and that would frighten a couple dolphins, and they could, you know, corral them off and kill them. But this is a whole different way of killing. This is genocide. This is species genocide. They do about, you know, over 20,000 a year around Japan, all around Japan. About 15% of them that they kill around the country come out of this little town, Taiji.
Mm-hmm. And they're not too worried about how they kill the dolphins in terms of doing it in a humane way, are they?
No, that was, you know, that's kind of the big reveal at the end of the movie, really. You know, but, you know, I do want to say that the movie's a PG-13. You know, you'll see more violence in a television police show than you'll, you know, than you will in the Cove. This is the Disney version of the violence that goes on back there. I've edited out all the really nasty stuff so that nobody should have to see that. So this is, you know, it's basically, you know, believe it or not, we made this film entertaining. It's more like a thriller or a Ocean's 11 film than it is a straight documentary. When most people see documentaries, I think they think of like, okay, this is like going to be, you know, taking your medicine or eating your vegetables. You know, it's going to be good for you.
Right.
You're not looking forward to it. This film is, it's high entertainment. In fact, you know, Pierce Brosnan wrote me a few months back, and he said it's one of the most exciting spy movies I've ever seen, and it's real.
Now, you tried to make this film legally at first. How far did that attempt go?
Well, I was trying to get the Japanese point of view on the subject. So, you know, respectfully, we went to the mayor's office and requested, you know, after requesting a meeting, we spent 7 hours in negotiations with them, about 5 hours the next day, the following day, with the dolphin hunters. And then at the end of the negotiation session, they said, we're not going to help you. In fact, it's very dangerous for you to be around this town. You should leave because you're in danger. You know, it's like, why? What are they hiding? You know, mm-hmm. I didn't really want to get into the cult, but now that they're making it, you know, so dangerous for me, it made me curious. And then I, you know, basically created the kind of an Ocean's 11 team to penetrate the secret cove. You know, I enlisted a bunch of friends and family from my former wife as a still photographer, and we created this team to penetrate the cove. We had George Lucas's, 3D division, now called Kerner Optical. They helped us make these fake rocks that we hid high-def cameras in. We had world champion freediver Mandy Ray Cruikshank. She was a friend of mine, a world champion freediver. She can go down to 300 feet in one breath of air and come back up on her own power. And her husband, who trains underwater freedivers, they helped to set the underwater, you know, video cameras and the hydrophones. We had unmanned drones that we had high-def, gyro-stabilized cameras below them that were controlled by remote control. We had, boy, a military-grade thermal camera that you're not supposed to bring out of the United States, but we did, so we could track the movements of the guards in the cove. You know, the cove is a natural fortress. It's protected on three sides by steep cliffs, a series of tunnels you need to get through on one side to get there. Guards, sensors, guard dogs, 24-hour police surveillance while we were in the country. I mean, it was like a military operation to get in there. It was extremely dangerous. I'm surprised we got away with it, and you know, the film is actually going to make some changes in Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, we on Tuesday of this week, we announced that we had a Japanese distributor on board to show the film in Japan. And people said that could never be done.
To begin in April, I understand the release. And there are also implications, not you've described them for the dolphins, but in the film you also described there are human health implications of what's happening in the cove, the practice of the Japanese here.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to stop this barbaric practice by proving that it's, you know, animal rights abuses. That's obvious when you look at the film. You know, we're going to stop it because it's human rights abuses. You know, the dolphin meat that the dolphin hunters have been serving up to school kids. When we got there serving it to school children, it was actually forced. School children were forced to eat dolphin meat all around Wakayama Prefecture. And even though that meat has anywhere from 5 to 5,000 times more mercury than allowed by Japanese health laws, the provisional limit for mercury in seafood in Japan is 0.4 parts per million. And dolphin meat, because they live really high on the food chain, it can have anywhere from 2,000 ppm, 2,000 parts per million of mercury, which is 5,000 times more mercury than allowed by Japanese law.
What you're describing must have given the Japanese authorities reason to change some things. Has this happened yet?
I think they're scrambling around trying to figure out what to do. You know, they've been trying to say it's their tradition. They've been trying to use all these, the same old arguments, but they don't work. You know, when your tradition, even if it was a tradition, you know, is making people poisoned, you get your tradition. And, you know, by the way, it's not just a Japanese problem. It's a worldwide problem. Every state in the United States has mercury advisories, warnings out. Even in Iowa, because, you know, we burn fossil fuels for coal, you know, coal for energy. That's polluting all the rivers, all the streams, all the lakes. You know, I'm from Dubuque, Iowa. And, you know, a lot of the fish that I used to catch as a kid, let's say up in Wisconsin, the walleye, pike, you can't eat a lot of that anymore because, you know, that's the fallout of burning all this coal is polluting the lakes all around the country. And that's the bigger message of the code. It's not just dolphins and whales that are toxic. It's everything that we like to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I found out through the making of this film that I had mercury poisoning, not just a little bit, but the highest my doctor had ever seen where I'm living now in Colorado. I had 40 parts per million. Anything over 1 is considered high. So, you know, this to me, this movie is really personal. It's not just a Japanese problem. It's a worldwide problem.
Do you know where you got those high levels, or is that typical of us Americans?
Well, that's typical of people. I'm a pescatarian. I don't eat things that walk. I haven't for over 25 years, but, you know, I'm still not a vegetarian. I eat things that come out of the ocean, and I eat a lot of it. That's all I ate for animal protein in the last 25 years was seafood. And when I went down to Minamata, Japan, that's where this mercury outbreak was, and I interviewed the doctors there. These are the scientists that study the victims of mercury poisoning. I interviewed them in the morning. I just want to tell you a quick story here. And I took them out for lunch. I offered to take them out for lunch, and they said, "Sure. What do you like to eat?" And I said, "Sushi." And so they took me to a sushi restaurant around from the hospital, and my Japanese interpreter ordered these big platters of Japanese seafood, and sushi. There was tuna. All kinds of delicious stuff, very expensive. And I looked down at the doctor's end of the table, and halfway through the meal, none of them were eating the seafood, not one single person. I said, what's with this? Japanese people eat more seafood than anybody on the planet, 66 kilos per person. That's about 140 pounds of seafood per person. They're basically eating their weight in seafood every year, like I was. And they said, well, you should know that, the six of us around this table were curious how fast mercury bioaccumulates in the human body. So we did this experiment, they told me, and it was called the supersize experiment, the Japanese style. They each ate 200 grams of tuna every day for a month. Now, 200 grams of tuna, if you think in ounces like I do, that's less than half a can of tuna fish. Mm-hmm. That's what I put on a couple crackers. And they bought the cheapest cuts of tuna that they could, and after the end of 2 weeks, their mercury levels had doubled in their body. One of the doctors dropped out of this, this experiment. Those five continued on, but they said, we just have to spring for the really good tuna, the sushi grade tuna. So they did, and their average level went up eight times. In a 1 month time, they're now into the levels of the victims that they're studying. And so this movie is a cautionary tale for anybody that eats seafood. I'm not saying don't eat seafood. You just can't eat it at the top of the food chain. Don't eat tuna, marlin, shark, tilefish. Unfortunately, even in the Midwest, if you're, if you're anywhere downwind from a coal plant, shouldn't be eating the freshwater trout or the pike either.
That's Louis Sahoyas, Dubuque native and director of The Cove, which is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. I spoke with him recently from the West Coast. Coming up, we'll hear about the formative experiences in Iowa and elsewhere that helped forge Sahoyas' passion for the ocean and its creatures. Then later this hour, we'll talk with another documentarian and Iowa native, Chip Duncan, about his latest book, Enough to Go Around. It's about relief organizations and their efforts around the world. That's as The Exchange continues here on Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest is Academy Award-nominated director and Iowa native, Louis Sahoyas. His film, The Cove, earned the Best Feature Documentary nomination for uncovering the largest dolphin slaughter in the world, in Japan. But Sahoyas is less concerned about filmmaking awards than he is about making a difference for the ocean and its creatures. I talked with him about founding the Oceanic Preservation Society and asked about its purpose.
To create awareness about ocean issues. I've been diving for about 35 years. I actually took my first certification course from Iowa State University when I think it was 1975. But I've been diving ever since, and every time I go in the water, but going back to the same place, I've been, you can't help but notice the degradation of the oceans happening before your very eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, part of this degradation, like I said, is the burning of fossil fuels. We're making the ocean so acidic from the burning of fossil fuels that we're going to be losing all the coral reefs by the end of the century, all of the coral reefs by the end of the century. Everything with a carbon structure in the ocean is starting to dissolve. But let me give you a quick science primer. Like plankton, the very, base of everything in the ocean, the very bottom of the food chain that everything relies on is starting to dissolve. We lost about 30% of the plankton. Well, you think, well, big deal. I don't live in the ocean. If I live in Iowa, what good is plankton to me? Well, 2 out of every 3 breaths you take, I'll say that once again, 2 out of every 3 breaths you take, you owe to plankton. Plankton generates far more oxygen than all the land plants in all the world. So, this is a huge, huge problem that we've uncovered. It's not me, but, the problems of acidification, they've only really been starting to get popularized since 2005. It's the other carbon problem. And for me, this is I love to dive in the ocean, and I love to breathe, and I love to, when you go camping, you want to leave the your campsite a little bit better than you found it. I think the same principle holds for when you come onto this planet, you should leave a little bit better than you found it. We're not doing that.
Louis, I wanted to play a little audio from your website. One of your divers in the film, Mandy Ray Cruikshank, I think just an eloquent statement about the way she as a human feels towards sea creatures. Let's listen to it.
When you're out swimming in the ocean and you have whales and dolphins come by you, it is one of the most incredible experiences ever. It's so humbling that this wild creature would come up and be so interested in you. It's unbelievable, really. Even though there's obviously no words spoken, you really feel like you're on some level communicating with them. Like there's an understanding between the two of you.
It's really ironic, I find, that a person growing up in Dubuque, Iowa, perhaps 1,000 miles away from the closest ocean, is a co-founder of a oceanic preservation society. When was your first encounter with a sea creature that made you think in these large terms of the connection?
Well, first of all, right now I live in Colorado, which is also a landlocked state, and we like to say that we're conveniently located between two oceans. But the truth is, NOAA, the National Oceanic and an Atmospheric Organization, is based in Boulder, Colorado. Right next door to me lives this woman who's the chairman of the board of the Coral Reef Alliance. Next door to that is a guy that started Google Oceans. We're there, all the oceanic organizations are there, so we can be with each other. That's where all the best science is being done, right there in Colorado. When I was, I guess I was 6, 7 years old when I was in Iowa watching Flipper, and the television program, that was sort of, one of the first sort of, encounters with sea creatures. I think a lot of people in my generation, that was their introduction to these, intelligent creatures out of the sea. And, the irony here is it was, Rick O'Berry, the guy that captured and trained the 5 female dolphins that collectively played the part of Flipper, that he took me into Taiji. He's the guy that did it. And, he spent 10 years building up that industry, the captive dolphin industry, and he spent the last 40 trying to tear it down. And he's the guy that brought me to Taiji, and he said, if we could just get into the cove, we can stop this genocide for these animals. Mm-hmm. And, my heart went out to him. I realized that, if I was a journalist like I've been trained to do for, the last, 35 years, I worked at the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. That's where I, started getting my chops in journalism. I thought, well, all the journalists that had come there before, New York Times, London Sunday Times, CNN, London Observer, all these news organizations have been turned away. And that's when I decided to help Rick, try to stop this, because it was a tragedy for me at epic proportions, for the animals and for human beings. I guess that was it, the Flipper TV series. That's what sort of opened up my eyes, and that's, Rick opened up a little bit further. He says in our movie, the dolphin smile is nature's greatest deception. It creates the illusion that they're always happy. And, dolphins have larger brains than human beings. They have more convolutions of the gray matter. They have, for sensory neurons, they're more sensitive than human beings. They have this extra sense, sonar. They can literally see right through you. They can see your heart beating. They're incredible creatures. And I've now, since in the last 5 years, I've dove with dolphins and whales in the wild all over the world. And when you look into the eye of a dolphin or a whale, I've done it frequently, it just makes you shake by thinking how, that this animal's looking right through you.
If you just joined us, Louis Sahoy is my guest, a photographer, documentary filmmaker, directed and starred in the Oscar-nominated film The Cove, which shows a secret dolphin killing field in Japan. I believe The Cove is a favorite to win the Academy Award for Best Documentary. What does the nomination and the possible win of the Oscar mean for your cause?
Well, two things. I mean, like I said, we've won a lot of awards. I didn't know that they even existed when I got into making films. But to me, winning awards is a collateral that happens when you try to raise awareness to the issue. I never got into this business to make movies. I got in to start a movement. I got into, and winning an award like the Oscar, what it does, or just getting nominated is an incredible honor. I mean, you've already won. As soon as you got a nomination, forever, my name will always say Luis Zoya's Oscar nominee. But to win gives you 45 seconds to talk to the world. Hmm. You have a billion people that watch this program worldwide, and more importantly, it's the most widely watched program in Japan. That's why I would love to, rise to the top a little bit further, so I can give the oceans a voice, give it, this movie a little bit bigger voice. But there's a lot of great documentaries out there this year.
Right.
You just think, I'm just happy to be here too. A little over a year ago, we would have been happy just to get into Sundance. We overshot our mark a little bit. And here we are on the Oscars.
Good for you. Let's end this, Luis Zoya's, by, if you have a draft in your head of those 45 seconds, please tell us, what do you want to say to the Academy, to all the viewers of those, if and when you receive that golden statue?
Well, I haven't had it refined yet, but the dolphin is the only creature throughout history known to save the life of a human being. The only way that we can save its life now is to prove that we made its environment so toxic that we shouldn't be eating them. I mean, I think in some ways we like to think that we've become technologically advanced and this, puts us above the other animals, but we're doing what no wild animal will do. We're following our own nest. Something along those lines. You want to leave it upbeat and hopeful, but, I'm working on it. It's a unique opportunity, and I don't want to blow it by thanking my gardener and my, my mother and, my agent.
Well, you mentioned Dubuque, Iowa, though, at least.
Here on the program, I will. Thank you, Dubuque, Iowa. You got me here this far. Appreciate it.
How have your prospects as a filmmaker been affected by this huge success? Lots of offers out there for you in the future?
Yeah, actually, it's just, they've been flooding in every day. And, I got to remind myself, I'm not a filmmaker. I'm in the save the world business, which is quite different.
Okay, you've got a larger calling. Luis Zoya's, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you. Good luck on Academy Award night, and it's been a pleasure talking with you.
A pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
A conversation I had with Academy Award-nominated director and Iowa native Luis Zoya's. His film, The Cove, is up for Best Feature Documentary. The Oscars air March 7th. Coming up, another documentary filmmaker and Iowa native, Chip Duncan, talks about his latest book, Enough to Go Around. It tells the story of international relief agencies working in some of the worst disaster areas in the world. We'll hear about his recent trip to Haiti as the exchange continues here on Iowa Public Radio. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Chip Duncan grew up in the small southwestern Iowa town of Shenandoah and also in Council Bluffs. His work as a filmmaker, photojournalist, and an author has taken him around the world to several areas that we hear about regularly in our news, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and he's just returned from Haiti. In his new book, Enough to Go Around, he captures in words and text the work of relief organizations that he has witnessed. Tomorrow evening, he'll be speaking at the Des Moines Public Library at 6:30. Chip Duncan also covered the aftermath of the devastating earthquake in Pakistan. I asked him about the difference between the earthquake in Pakistan and the one he recently covered in Haiti.
The big challenge in Haiti, the infrastructure there was obviously not good to begin with. And then when you couple that with the fact that most of their government was shut down. Many, many people were killed. Ministries were literally toppled. And then the United Nations, which would have been normally able to provide some infrastructure, was also devastated. So the coordinating entities that you would normally be able to rely on after a major crisis were not in place. And then in addition, unlike the Pakistan quake, the population density was extreme. And so you saw a much higher death toll in Haiti, although the displacement figures in Pakistan were much greater. By contrast, Pakistan quake was a 7.6 on the Richter scale. Haiti was 7.0. In Pakistan, I did not see a single dwelling left standing anywhere near the epicenter. In Haiti, it was a little more mixed. A lot of the devastation had to do with poor construction techniques and population density. So very, very different in terms of the impact of the two quakes.
During your recent 6-day trip to Haiti, what were the images you'll remember most from that trip?
Well, that's an interesting question because I had worked in Haiti previously on a TV series for Discovery Channel, a series called Mystic Lands, and I'd focused on Haitian rituals, especially voodoo, for that series. So I was already familiar with Haiti, and it is, prior to the quake, it was one of the most devastated places I've ever photographed. And so I had, in terms of this event, the main difference from Haiti before the quake and after the quake was the loss of life and the dilapidated structures. So having said that, I spent a lot of time in Cité Soleil, the major slum in Haiti. I spent a lot of time there previously, and the living conditions were really quite poor to begin with. So if I were to pick an image, I guess this may sound contrary to what a lot of people would think, but I focused quite a bit on survivors, and so I have images of children and parents with their children that I think are quite moving, and they are the survivors. They're the hope. They're the future of Haiti.
As you do in your new book, Enough to Go Around, you concentrate on survivors. We get to see faces, insights, views of these cultures and these people that our news certainly doesn't deliver. Your new book takes us on a journey through three of the most desperate and misunderstood places on the planet, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. Why did you choose these three places?
Well, interestingly, they chose me. I had worked with an NGO called Save the Children prior to visiting any of these places. I'd done a film for PBS where I focused a bit on their work in Ethiopia, and I was moved by the work that they were doing and volunteered to document for them and was dispatched to Afghanistan in 2005. So my first mission was really that they chose the country and I agreed to go and volunteer my time and document there. The other two, however, were more specific. I started working with an NGO called Relief International that's a Los Angeles-based non-governmental organization. And in my work with them, they were focused heavily on Pakistan following the earthquake of 2005 in Pakistan. I volunteered to work there, and then shortly after that, I joined their board. And each board member has adopted countries, and one of the places that I adopted was Sudan and Darfur in particular. So I volunteered and went to Darfur in January of 2008. And I guess over the last 25 years of filmmaking and photography and writing, I've become fairly adept at moving through countries in crisis and you know, learning how to navigate my own personal needs in those situations. So in that sense, I'm a really low-maintenance photographer and filmmaker, so I try to be able to adapt to a culture and adapt to a situation and not try and control it, but rather just go in and photograph.
Your new book, Enough to Go Around, is told in the first person. It uses photographs, quite dramatic, but not all depressing photos, which you might expect given the content here, to document your personal experiences with humanitarian organizations and the people they serve. Why did you take this very personal approach and the focus that you did?
Well, I found in most places that are in crisis, and Darfur would be one example, certainly Afghanistan another, it's we are fairly well inundated with the photos of destruction, or the photos showing a partially burned body, or someone who's recovering from an explosion. I think news journalists are doing a good job of conveying those images, and I certainly feel I can, my response requires that, I will take those pictures. But I felt a need to focus on the people who were survivors in many cases, or who are simply been displaced by the conflicts. And so for me, it's an opportunity to put a face on those people. I mean, it's interesting. We've been at war with Afghanistan for almost 9 years now, and yet very few Americans know much about the Afghan people. They don't know what their roots are, their ethnic roots, their tribal roots, their religious practices. I think most people would be surprised to learn that, at least in my opinion, Afghanistan is not a particularly, dogmatic or religiously dogmatic country. And so while on the one hand, you might have an extremist Islamic group like the Taliban running the country for a period of time, that's not the spirit that I found out in the countryside or in villages or cities around the country. Most people are just trying to get through their lives. They're trying to put food on the table. They're trying to make a living. They're trying to take care of their loved ones, much like Americans would. And so for me, it's an opportunity to put a face on those people, and especially the people living in IDP camps, or refugee camps, as they're called.
Is this book, can it be taken as a criticism of our news media, a news media that makes us view the world almost only as threatening and is not accurate in that way?
Well, I came from a news background, and I can tell you that that in my experience, the drive of most news organizations is to get the day's broadcast on the air. And a lot of times, the more dramatic, the more adrenaline-focused the events are, the more likely it is to draw viewers. So it's not so much that I'm here to criticize them. That is the job that they perceive themselves doing oftentimes. But it's rare for the news organizations to give the kind of time that's required to go a little bit deeper. And so, I made my own decision literally 20-some-odd years ago to move out of news and to move into long-form television, which is why I've been working primarily in public television. That's a venue where you can tell longer, more detailed stories. But the book, I suppose some people could view it as that kind of thing. For me, I'm not so much focused on what the problems are with news as trying to do my own job, which is to take a different spin and show a different side of the issues.
Of course, U.S. Marines and Afghan troops are battling insurgents in a new major offensive across the Taliban haven of Marja, a major offensive to reclaim this extremist southern heartland. Once they have that area under control, they plan to quickly deliver aid to the people and quickly set up a functioning local government. What are your thoughts about this latest offensive and the new way in which the Obama administration is approaching Afghanistan?
If I'm going to take the approach of giving my own opinion, I'd say that generally speaking, I'm not really sure why we're in Afghanistan. I'm not sure that the troop buildup is necessarily something that I would support. Having said that, the approach of the Obama administration to Afghanistan is much better, I think, than anything we've seen previously. I found it fascinating that part of the McChrystal tactic with Helmand Province was to actually announce it ahead of time. I mean, I think that's it's not a question of who has the superior fighting force. It's a question of how do you want to interact with these people in the long term. And I think announcing the mission ahead of time was a smart thing to do. He has made, and Obama have both made, a real commitment to avoid civilian casualties. So I'm sure they're devastated by what happened over the weekend. I know I am. Having said all of that, the big problem in Helmand Province is poppies and drug trade. And so, it's interesting that we're not focusing, if you'll notice this, the focus is not on extreme Islam in Helmand Province. The focus is on drugs and poppies. And that's a very different kind of conflict than what you might find in eastern Afghanistan.
You note in your book Rudyard Kipling's remark that Afghanistan can't really be conquered. You share that view?
Yeah, actually I do. I mean, it's who knows what a fighting force like the United States can do. Certainly the Soviets came to the conclusion that it wasn't worth staying. If we can build the kind of infrastructure for schools and water and food and sustainable development in Afghanistan, then I think we can succeed there. That's an effort. Excuse me. That's an effort the Soviets did not undertake. So, if we start turning more to the humanitarian pursuits, I think we can succeed. And I think when it comes to education, there's huge differences between Afghanistan and Iraq. The literacy rate in Iraq was very high. Most people could read. Most people were well-educated. In Afghanistan, that's not the case. I mean, I've seen literacy figures as low as 12%. So it's a very different kind of conflict when even the people you're trying to train can't read. So, you know, if you're looking at long-term solutions, I think, for example, Greg Mortensen's approach building schools, I think, is a very good one. I think groups like Relief International that are in there that are providing sustainable resources and doing long-term development, I think that's more likely a road to success. Without that, I think Kipling's words will probably become true, because the landscape of Afghanistan is a big part of what makes it unconquerable.
If you've just joined us, my guest is filmmaker, photojournalist, and author Chip Duncan, Iowa native, grew up in Shenandoah and Council Bluffs. In a chapter of your book called Abraham's Sandwich, you mentioned the word Anyi, or Anyi. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. What is Anyi?
It's actually pronounced Aini. The word is spelled A-Y-N-I. And it's interesting. I love getting the question because having nothing to do with the book, I've worked in Peru for many, many years with the spiritual community in the Andes. And in the Quechua language there, they have a word called Aini, and the word means sharing or reciprocity. But when the locals try and translate it into English, they always add the caveat that really English doesn't have the right words for it. And so it means sharing, it means reciprocity, but it really means more than that. And the story I tell in the book is about an aid worker in southern Ethiopia. And the story is a very simple story about how he shared his sandwich with someone who was just walking by. Literally in the middle of nowhere, just someone walking by wasn't begging, and the aid worker his name was Abraham, he simply tore his sandwich in half and shared it. And what that notion articulated for me was, here I am in Ethiopia, and yet thousands of miles away in Peru, the word that I would use to articulate what his actions expressed to me was Aini, which means sharing without really thinking about sharing, or an unconscious kind of sharing, or sharing without expectation of something in return. And it was really that action that led to my, simple thing, I guess, but it led to my own commitment to try and volunteer with different NGOs and start providing services for them when they need them.
Mm-hmm. Was there a photo in your book you think particularly captures particularly well this notion of Aini?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I think in a sense they all do, because there's so many images of people smiling and being positive in the midst of crisis. So I think there's an image of a man in Afghanistan who's lost three of his limbs to landmines, and yet he's sitting in front of a mosque, and he's got a huge grin on his face, and he's gesturing with his thumb up in the air. And somehow that spirit, I think, articulates the fact that even in the midst of what most people would be devastated by, he still manages to give a smile or to stay positive. And so in a sense that accomplishes that. The other thing I would say about the photos is that I went out of my way to take a lot of photos of Muslim men smiling. And there's a couple of spreads in the book. The book is designed much like a coffee table book, and there's a couple of photo spreads in there that I really like that just show Muslim men smiling. And those are images that we rarely see from the news media here. You know, for any number of reasons, men in turbans are too often portrayed as somehow having some kind of deviance or negativity associated with them. And in Afghanistan in particular, that simply isn't the case. Most of the people that we encountered were quite lovely and oftentimes had a great sense of humor and were quick to flash a smile. So I tried to capture